trinity of chicken, pasta, and salad, the shaft meal, or the gruel. Then there's the equipment. Since the introduction of the Cuisinart, any food processor can be referred to as the Cuis. The square and oblong metal sauce containers are 6 pans or 8 pans, depending on size, and the long, shallow ones, hotels. The cook spoons with holes or slots are unsurprisingly female, and the unslotted ones, male. Mise is mise en place, your setup, your station prep, your assembled ingredients, and to some extent, your state of mind. A la minute is made to order from start to finish. Order, when yelled at a cook, means make initial preparations, such as searing, half-cooking, setting up for finishing. Fire means finish cooking and get ready for pickup. Food ready to be picked up is put in the window or on the ventana, also called the pass, the slide, or the shelf. The slide refers to the slotted rack where dupes or tickets containing orders hang. So one could say, what orders do I have hanging? And the reply could be, you've got 2 steak on order for the deuce on 5, 3 souls are fired. A cook might ask for an all day, a total number of a particular item both ordered and fired with temperatures, meaning degrees of doneness, and on the fly means rush. A wipe means just what it sounds like, a last-minute plate cleaning. Marijuana or mota or chronic is chopped parsley. Jizz is any reduced liquid like demi-glace. When one adds whole butter to jizz, one is mounting, as in Monte au beurre. Cook well done translates to burn it, or murder it, or kill it. When one finds oneself waiting too long for a well-done steak to finish cooking, and it's holding up the rest of the order, one can suggest throwing it in the jukebox, or giving it a little radar love in the micro, or microwave. The latex surgical gloves we rarely wear are anal research gloves, and one usually puts them on with some theatrical flourish, snapping and grinning menacingly, accompanied by suggestions to turn left and cough or grab your ankles because here comes Papi Chulo. Those paper toques are coffee filters or clown hats. The check pants we all wear are simply checks, our jackets and aprons, whites. When the boss arrives, it's Elvis is in the building or psst, desastre es aquí, and the usual nicknames apply to any and all. Cooks, waiters, busboys, and runners alike. Crude irony abounds. Cachondo, meaning piece of ass, might be applied to a particularly homely runner. Caliban, meaning strong man, is reserved for a weak cook. Reo, or flash, to a slowpoke. Baboso, or drooling idiot, to, well, any drooling idiot. Any blonde, well-scrubbed waiter can become Opie, Richie Cunningham, or Doogie Howser motherfucker. Stocky busboy sounds like burro to me. When referring to themselves collectively, my Mexican carnales like La Raza, or La M.A., or La Mafia. Externs from culinary school working for free as a learning experience, which by itself translates to lots of work and no money, are quickly tagged as FNG, fucking new guy, or Mel for Mal Carne, bad meat, Army, short for Army cook, or the classic but elegant Shoe, short for shoemaker, are the perennial insults for a lousy or slophouse cook. There are the usual terms of endearment, all perfectly acceptable in casual conversation between cooks. Motherfucker, a compliment. Cocksucker, son of beach, dipshit, scumbag, scumsucker, dumbfuck, rat bastard, slackjaw, idiota, bruto, animal, asesino, mentiroso, whining little bedwetter, turd, tortuga, strun, sallow, salopal, chocha podrida, pendejo, silly cunt, seso de pollo, spaz, goofball, buckethead, chucha, papi chulo, sweet cheeks, cupcakes, love chunks, culero, shit stain, cum gargler, and so on. Asshole, strangely, is serious, to be used only when genuinely angry, and any expression involving a person's wife, mother, girlfriend, boyfriend, or family member directly, with the notable exception of motherfucker, is strictly off-limits. You may well have seen your grill man's wife jacking off motorists for spare change on West Street, but you don't talk about it ever. A lot of cook talk is transplanted from the fringes of military jargon. One doesn't carry, one humps. To be set up is to be squared away. He sucks it up and endures, digs in for the rush, takes a bad hit if one station is disproportionately busy, is simply fucked or fucked in the ass when things go badly, at which point one's buddy hopefully steps in and bails you out, covers your ass, saves your bacon. Aspirins are called crunchies because we eat them like candy. Finger cots are condom, pronounced with Spanish inflection. The nail on which completed orders are spindled is the spike. Any round metal container placed in a water bath is a bane from bain-marie, or simply a crock. The life we live is la puta vida, this bitch of a life, and one might well bemoan a sorry state of affairs with a cry of porca miseria, pig of misery, or que dolor, what pain. The slide, when full of dupes, is called the board, as in, the board is full. Food currently being loaded by a runner or a waiter is my hand, as in, where's that fucking steak? Reply, my hand, chef. A hot nut is used when an expediter wants something now. I got a hot nut for that soul on table 6. This is often for a VIP, or very important pendejo, or PPX, or soigné motherfucker, meaning friend of the owner or the man himself. So make sure to move that food out and rush, or stat. Applying what we've learned to a battlefield situation, one might find oneself saying, I got a hot nut for that 6 top on 7, cabrón. It's been fired for 10 fucking minutos, pinche tortuga. What, you don't got your mies together, asesino? Get that shit in the window. You say so to pollo, pinche grill man. Throw it in the fucking jukebox if you have to. The rest of the order, my hand. And don't forget to give it a wipe and some mota and a squirt of that red jizz on the way out. I got shit hanging here, and you were falling in the fucking weeds. Working, might come the reply. I'm getting buried here. How come Soteno getting slammed like me? I take it in the ass all night. How about the table 8? Fire? I can go on 8? Which might inspire this. 8 my hand, baboso. 8 fucking gone. 8 fucking dying on la ventana waiting for Doogie Howser motherfucker to pick up. You got dead dupes back there, idiota. What the fuck are you doing? You are in the shit. Hey, Rayo, step in and bail the culero out. Other bodies. Runners are the chef's imperial guard. Half-breeds who dress like waiters, are paid out of the front of the house payroll, but whose loyalties lie ideally with the chef and the kitchen. Usually ex-busboys or exiled waiters, they must choose sides early, especially as they will be called upon to perform tasks that might be interpreted as contrary to the aims of their former comrades. I like wide-bodied, highly motivated runners. My runners, particularly in busy pre-theater operations, where the entire dining room has to be served during a 30 to 40 minute period, are generally whipped into such a frenzy of enthusiasm, fear, and naked aggression that I'm constantly being asked to tell them to refrain from bowling over the waiters on their missile-like progress to and from the kitchen. It takes unusual skills to be a runner. Language skills are not important. I want dedication, speed, the ability to gauge quickly what the hell is going on in a busy and hectic situation, pick out the next order from a busy array of outgoing orders, carry multiple plates at one time without dropping them, remember position numbers and donenesses at the table, and prioritize sensibly. Runners usually get a full cut of waiters' tips, with the advantage that they don't have to deal with the general public in order to get paid. Their job is to shuttle food in the proper order, out of the kitchen and to the customer, and to get back to the kitchen quickly. Their job is also to do the chef's bidding, whatever that might entail. Other, more nebulous tasks might include intelligence gathering, like a forward artillery observer reporting back to the chef expediter such cogent bits of data like the answer to what's going on table 1, are they ready for their food, how's the special going over, and so on. Fetching drinks for the chef might be a regular duty as well, or taking his jacket to the cleaners, running to the store for emergency supplies, maintaining a clean window and service area, arranging garnishes, even occasional expediting duties. Most of my runners may not know how to speak English, but they know every dish on my menu and how to pronounce it. A runner should be able to pick out a medium-rare steak from a group of other dunnesses, read a board as well as the chef, and maintain that rabid pre-game caged animal mentality one looks for in a professional fullback. I want my runners hyperventilating like Marines about to take a hill before the rush comes. As far as I'm concerned, I am General Patton when it comes to questions of judgment or strategy. Their mission? Get that food out there and get back here fast. I have my beautiful food dying under the heat lamps. I don't want my runner stopping off to decrumb a table or empty an ashtray. And it's useful if my wide-bodied runners can be utilized as enforcers, dealing subtly, if forcefully, with interlopers who would invade my domain and impede the serious business of cooking and serving my food. Some friend of the owner, salesman, or chatty waiter is blocking the lane of my kitchen. He's going to get an elbow in the kidney every time one of my chunky runners passes him by. After a few of these inadvertent bumps and elbow checks, people usually get the message that they're in the way. A really good runner is a rare and beautiful find. In the best cases, there is a near telepathic relationship between chef and runner, requiring only a glance or a facial expression to communicate scads of information. A really good runner will read the dupes over the shoulder of his master, between orders, immediately identifying what will likely come next and where it's going. Some diplomatic skills are nice, too, as my cooks are likely to take umbrage if asked to refire a steak or rush an order in a tone of voice they find grating. A runner who's willing to snitch on his old pals out on the floor is useful as well. I always like to know if there's some pocket of dissidence welling up out there. If some jumped-up maitre d' is bad-mouthing me or my specials, I'll probably have to deal with it somewhere down the road. so I'd rather know sooner than later. Early warning is always a good thing. Did a busload of tourists just pull up outside the restaurant, all of them planning on jamming a quick three-course meal into their maws before curtain goes up for Miss Saigon? If my runner doesn't tell me, who will? The waiters and hosts will be too busy shoving tables together and arguing about whether to tack 18 or 20% on their bill. Though nominally floor staff, in time, as runners become comfortable with the customs and practices of the kitchen, they begin to acquire the same unique worldview, that xenophobic, slightly paranoid perspective of everything that exists outside the kitchen doors, the same ghoulish sense of humor and suspicion of non-kitchen personnel. I like to encourage this, making sure my runners are fed better, flattering them on occasion, taking an interest in their personal lives and finances. I will, when necessary, put the full weight of my strange and terrible power behind them should they need it. Those part-time actors on the floor holding out on one of my runners, shorting him on his cut, God help the night porter. I wish I didn't need a night porter, but I do. Somebody has to clean the restaurant after service, take out the garbage, clean and scrub the insides of the ovens, toss out the dead mice, kill the dying ones, empty the grease traps, hose down the kitchen, all the tasks that no one else in his right mind would do for love or money. The problem is, you have the sort of person who is willing to do this kind of work alone and unsupervised in your restaurant all night long. It's thankless, dirty work, dragging leaking, smelly garbage bags out to the dumpster. And as the night porter is all by himself, he might well feel justified in taking full advantage of certain fringe benefits. He could call his family in Mexico on the house phone. He could eat whatever he finds available and not likely to be missed. He could perhaps take a drink from those bottles he's dusting. And best yet, he can keep whatever he finds in the dining room. Let's face it, the guy who sweeps and mops a busy restaurant's dining room after a packed Saturday night is going to find some interesting stuff. Wallets, jewelry, credit cards, cell phones, handbags, umbrellas, drugs, cash. These kinds of things are regularly left behind by customers. The night porter is probably coming up with some interesting goodies in the employee locker room as well, fallen from hastily removed uniforms, so an enterprising fellow can supplement his income in all sorts of ways. As no one else wants the job, or even wants to stay up all night watching him do the job, or wants to train someone else to do the job, he's got a pretty secure position, even if suspected of occasional petty thievery. Even a known sneak thief porter is a valued employee, as long as he knows what he can steal and what he can't. There are, I'm sure, many apartments in the outer reaches of Queens that are fully furnished with the glassware, utensils, and kitchen equipment of many a restaurant. And a guy who knows where to buy a green card and a social security number for $30 probably knows what to do with a hot credit card or where to fence a used Burberry raincoat. Nobody minds much. Besides, the guy's probably stealing less than the bartender. The bartender, the chef's friend. There has long been a happy, symbiotic relationship between kitchen and bar. Simply put, the kitchen wants booze, and the bartender wants food. The bartender, seeing himself rightly as a more exalted creature than the waiters, would like to eat a little better than the employee gruel hardening under the heat lamps between 4 and 5. By the end of his shift, he's hungry. And chicken legs and day-old pasta don't fit with the bartender's image of himself as a raconteur, showman, and personality. He wants to be treated as special, and he usually is. The chef wants to drink anything he desires, any time he wants it, without upper management being fully informed of the extent of his alcoholism or his taste for premium liquors, and the bartender is usually happy to help, if handled correctly. The bartender, being the guy every employee gripes to at one point or another, is also useful for gathering interesting tidbits of intelligence. He is also privy at times to the high-level maneuverings of upper management and ownership. He knows, in dollars, how well or how poorly the place did on a given night, who is getting petty cash payouts, and for what purpose. And he's heard plenty. Everyone, sooner or later, forgets that the bartender is not really like a doctor or a priest and obliged to keep confidences. They forget that, yes, he is listening while you bitch about the boss to a friend at the far end of his bar. Hopefully he's going to tell the chef all about it. Earlier, I rashly implied that all bartenders are thieves. This is not entirely accurate, though of all restaurant workers, it's the bartender who has the greatest and most varied opportunities for chicanery. The bartenders control the register. They can collude with waiters on dinner checks. They can sell drinks out of their own bottles. I've even heard of a bartender who brought in his own register, ringing a third of the drinks there and simply carrying the whole thing home at night. But the most common bartender hustle is simply the buyback, when he gives out free drinks every second or third round to an appreciative customer. If you're drinking single malt all night long and only paying for half of them, that's a significant saving. An extra $10 or $20 tip to the generous barkeep is still a bargain. This kind of freewheeling with the house liquor is also personally good for the bartender. It inspires that most valued phenomenon in a regular bar crowd, a following, folks who will actually follow you wherever you work. Chefs naturally love this kind of bartender, and as a rule will not drink anywhere where there isn't this kind of trade discount. After work, posses of chefs and cooks will bounce from bar to bar on a loose, rotating basis, taking full advantage of the liberal pouring policies of bartenders they know from working with them before. They're careful not to burn their favorites, hitting their bar too hard or too often, which is why they tend to move from place to place. The bartender's repaid when he swings by their restaurants with a dinner date and gets treated like a pasha. Free snackies, maybe some free desserts, a visit from the chef, fawning personal service. In short, the kind of warm welcome and name recognition all of us beaten-down working-class slobs crave when going out to dinner. Adam, real last name unknown. The kitchen phone rang, followed by a beep, the little green light indicating that the hostess at the front desk had a call for me. "Yeah," I said, covering one ear so I could understand what she was saying over the radio and the clatter of pots and the noise of the dishwasher. "Call for the chef," she said. "Line two." I pressed the red flashing light, signaled for Stephen at the grill to turn down the radio. "Feed the bitch," said the voice on the phone. "Feed the bitch or she'll die." It was Adam. What he wanted me to do, what he was telling me, was that he was too drunk, too tired, too lazy, too involved in some squalid personal circumstances to come in and feed his starter, a massive, foaming, barely contained heap of fermenting grapes, flour, water, sugar, and yeast, which even now was pushing up the weighted down lid of a 35-gallon Lexan container and spilling over on the work table where it was stored. "Adam, we're busy here," I protested. "Tell him I'm not doing it," yelled Stephen from the line. He'd been expecting this call. "Tell him I'm letting her die if he doesn't get his ass in here." "Dude, I've got, like, a situation here, man, and, like, I just can't. Please, do me a favor, I promise. I'll bake tomorrow night. Please. Feed the bitch." "What's so important? What's so important you can't come in here?" I asked, knowingly soliciting an untruth. "Dude, they're trying to evict me from my apartment, and, like, I gotta be here. I have to be here when my lawyer calls, man." "They're always trying to evict you from your apartment, Adam," I said. "So what else is new?" Yeah, but this time it's serious," said Adam, slurring his words slightly. "I gotta wait for my lawyer to call, otherwise I'm fucked, you know?" "What lawyers call at 8:30 on a Friday night, Adam?" "Well, he's not really a lawyer, per se. He's more like a guy who's helping me." I could picture the scene on the other end of the phone. Adam, real last name unknown, the psychotic bread baker, alone in his small, filthy Upper West Side apartment, his eyes two different sizes after a 36-hour coke and liquor jag, white crust accumulated at the corners of his mouth, a 2-day growth of whiskers, standing there in a shirt and no pants amongst the porno mags, the empty Chinese takeout containers, as the Spice Channel flickers silently on the TV, throwing blue light on a can of Dinty Moore beef stew by an unmade bed. He's been snorting coke and smoking weed and drinking vodka from a half-gallon jug of Wolfschmitz or Fleischmann's. If he's drinking a better brand, he probably stole it from the restaurant. And now he's out of money. He doesn't have enough for a cab, and he's too lazy and incoherent to hump 20 blocks down and feed the bitch. I pondered the situation, looking first at the 250-pound blob of starter and then at Stephen. "I'm not doing it," said Stephen. His voice gets high and squeaky when he gets indignant. "Tell Vinny to go fuck himself." Stephen calls Adam Vinny. I don't know why. Maybe it's his real name. I kept Adam waiting. "I'll help you feed her, man," I told Stephen. "I don't want to look at the guy the way he sounds. You really want to see him? The condition he's in? You know how he gets." All right," said Stephen, grumbling under his breath as he slapped a steak on the grill. "This is the last time, though. Tell him. Tell him that next time I'm going to let her die. I'm going to throw her in the trash. We can buy bread." "We'll feed her," I told Adam. I was now committed to wrestling a backbreakingly heavy, ungainly blob out of the plastic Lexan, heaping it in stages into the big Hobart mixer, and feeding it with a mix of warm water and fresh flour and yeast. Then I'd have to scrape it back into the Lexan, haul that back up onto its resting place, stack sheet pans and potato sacks on top of it. It was a two-man job, one that would leave flour and goop all over my clean kitchen, leave dough under my fingernails and clinging to my clogs. But anything was preferable to having Adam, real last name unknown, in my kitchen right now. Anything. Why did God, in all his wisdom, choose Adam to be the recipient of greatness? Why, of all his creatures, did he choose this loud, dirty, unkempt, obnoxious, uncontrollable, megalomaniacal madman to be his personal bread baker? How was it that this disgrace, as an employee, as a citizen, as a human being, this undocumented, untrained, uneducated, and unwashed mental case, who's been employed for about 10 minutes, by every kitchen in New York, could throw together a little flour and water and make magic happen? And I'm talking real magic here, people. I may have wanted Adam dead 1,000 times over. I may have imagined, even planned his demise, torn apart by rabid dogs, his entrails snapped at by ravenous dachshunds, chained to a pillory post and flogged with chains and barbed wire before being drawn and quartered. But his bread and his pizza crust are simply divine. To see his bread coming out of the oven, to smell it, that deeply satisfying, spiritually comforting waft of yeasty goodness, to tear into it, breaking apart that floury, dusty crust and into the ethereally textured interior, to taste it is to experience real genius. His peasant-style boules are the perfect objects, an arrangement of atoms unimprovable by God or man, pleasing to all the senses at once. Cézanne would have wanted to paint them, but might not have considered himself up to the job. Adam, real last name unknown, may be the enemy of polite society, a menace to any happy kitchen, a security risk, and a potential serial killer, but the man can bake. He's an idiot savant with whom God has serious, frequent, and intimate conversations. I just can't imagine what he's telling him, or whether the message is getting garbled during transmission. The Crusaders of yore, it is said, used to stop off at the local church or monastery before heading off to war, where they were allowed to purchase indulgences. This was sort of like a secured prepaid credit card from heaven, I imagine, and negotiations probably went something like this. Bless me, Father, for I'm about to sin. I plan on raping, pillaging, and disemboweling my way across southern Europe and North Africa, taking the Lord's name in vain, committing sodomy with all and sundry, looting the holy places of Islam, killing women and children and animals and leaving them in smoking heaps, as well, of course, as getting up to the usual soldierly hijinks of casual eye gougings, dismemberment, bear-baiting, and arson. Given this sinful agenda, Padre, how much is this going to cost me? That'll be a new roof for the vestry, my son. Perhaps a few carpets from down there. I understand they make a lovely carpet where you'll be going in. Shall we say 15% off the top as a tithe? Deal. Go in peace, my son. Adam gets right with God every proof rack of sourdough bread he pulls out of the oven, every crispy, crunchy, deliciously blistered pizza. It's God's little joke on all of us, especially me. I've hired him 3 or 4 times and fired and rehired him again on countless occasions. He's in his late 20s to early 30s, I think, though he looks older. He's of medium height with lank black hair thinning at the crown. He's barrel-chested with the huge shoulders and upper arms of a guy who's been balling dough for years. His eyes are brown, but they look coal black, at once menacing and pathetic, set into a mischievous baby face whose expression can change in an instant from huggably endearing and childlike to slaveringly insane. To sign on Adam to your crew is to buy, for a time, the best bread I've ever tasted. It ensures that your customers, when examining their bread baskets, will exclaim, "Where did you get this bread? And where can I buy this bread?" It also means that your life will be a waking nightmare, that every corner of your walk-ins and kitchen shelving will be likely to contain various sinister-looking and foul-smelling science experiments, rotting grapes, fermenting red peppers, soggy buckets of mushroom trimmings, the gills and stems decomposing in a noxious black sludge, all of them destined for the bitch, or one of her many offspring, smaller batches of starter that have been flavored with or started by one of these primordial oozes. Walk-ins will contain buckets of slowed-down starter and forgotten batches of dead starter. Freezers will be loaded with half-baked boules, frozen sour mix, the floors sticky with dough. Like some virulent snail, Adam leaves tracks. But he also leaves the stuff. The most amazing olive and herb breads, pepper bread, mushroom bread, focaccias, pizzas, garlic twists, breadsticks, and brioche. He claims to be of Sicilian heritage, affecting the mannerisms and gestures and expressions of the street guinea from some Scorsese-inspired Brooklyn. But is he actually of Italian lineage? No one knows for sure. Stephen claims to have seen his birth certificate, the real one, mind you, and that his last name is Turkish or Arab. But who knows? Documentation from Adam is always of dubious provenance. His cooking background is certainly Italian, no question there. He is not to be relied on for baguettes. If you believe him, which you shouldn't, he was taught to bake by Lydia Bastianich. He's fond of showing off a tattered and dog-eared copy of one of her books inscribed to one of his many known aliases. He's worked, to my direct knowledge, as a cook, chef, consultant, pie man at pizzerias, deli help, pâtissier, and baker. Half of what comes out of his mouth is utter bullshit, the rest suspicious at best. He's perpetually broken in debt. The corner deli, says Stephen, gives him credit, as does his local bar. And Adam pays them during the good times and stiffs them in the bad. He's always headed off to Little Italy to pay off some shady character, cop weed, or settle his rent problems. He used to sue everyone he worked for, claiming harassment, breach of contract, theft of services, unfair labor practices, even sexual harassment. and has had surprisingly good luck with his second career as professional litigator. Many of his victims, I suspect, were willing to pony up a few dollars just to make him go away. Jimmy Sears, who first brought Adam's real last name unknown into my circle of acquaintances, the notorious Stephen and Adam acquisition of the 92 season, is another reluctant admirer. Like me, Jimmy should know better than to let this savage beast wander free in his kitchen, but he keeps doing it, keeps hiring him for the stuff. The Sears-Adam relationship has been a legendarily contentious one, coming to blows on more than one occasion. They have been both arch-enemies and close associates, rolling around trying to kill each other on the lawns at the Inn at Quag, having wrestling matches at 13 Barrow and screaming contests at the Supper Club. Stephen, who's known Adam longest, has had many adventures with him, both here in New York and in California. Episodes of such nauseating stupidity, self-indulgence, cruelty, and horror that even I find them unprintable. Adam has threatened to sue me many times. He has sued Sears, I believe, a number of times, as his assessment of what he is owed is frequently at odds with reality. To be fair, Jimmy's assessment of what he owes is sometimes at variance with established fact as well. There's a photo taken years ago for a magazine article that was never printed, showing Adam covered from head to toe in flour, holding Jimmy in a headlock, pretending to bash his skull in with a rolling pin. It was the perfect recreation of their relationship. Just recently, after many years, I stopped by to see Jimmy Sears at his new place, a swank nightclub supper club in the Gramercy area. I sat down at a table, ordered some food. Jimmy's food is always excellent. And when the breadbasket arrived, I looked up from the table at Jimmy with a horrible sense of recognition. "You didn't," I rasped, scarcely able to believe it. "I did," said Jimmy, sighing. "I have Adam making my bread and my pizza." The last I'd heard, Adam was bragging about getting the marshals to yank out Sears' stoves and equipment to pay off his claim of non-payment, claiming he was going to bash Jimmy's skull into red paste this time, make him cry like a little girl, destroy his life. The previous year, Adam had had to be delivered to the West Hampton train station under police escort after one of the famous Quag incidents, the Hamptons' first forced deportation. Jimmy was Adam's favorite obsession, a ready-to-go revenge scenario, his number one topic of conversation. Now, like so many relationships in the restaurant business, everything old was new again. To endure Adam as an employee was to become a full-time cop, psychiatrist, moneylender, friend, and antagonist, though he does have his sweet side. Stephen, Nancy, and I went skiing with him one time. Adam was thrilled to be doing something normal. Dr. Herbert Cleckley, in his groundbreaking work on serial killers, The Mask of Sanity, discusses this phenomenon, where the career sociopath, vestigially aware of his character, emulates normalcy by overcompensating, becoming a scoutmaster, a crisis line counselor, a Republican fundraiser. In this case, Adam, excited by the prospect of a wholesome activity like going skiing with the guys, prepared a bacchanalian picnic lunch for his fellow skiers, two chest coolers filled with homemade caponata, antipasto, sliced cold cuts, freshly baked Italian bread, cheese, marinated artichokes, roasted peppers. He must have been up all night getting it ready, and he skied like a hero, though he's the last person in the world who should be allowed. He had his ski boots on the wrong feet for the first hour. He neglected to bring gloves or mittens. He lost a ski pole, but he soldiered on without complaint. I vividly recall looking down from the ski lift, seeing him fall on his face, then clamber up again, and thinking, you know, there is something to love about this guy, beyond the bread. He's an extraordinary survivor, a man who has attained some nice highs and endured some truly low lows and always managed to bounce back. Maybe he's calling himself something else this time around. Maybe his paychecks are made out to some fictional company, a third party, his latest alias. But he's still on his feet at the end of the day and still making that incredible bread. Adam is not a stupid guy, though I sometimes think he aspires to be. His anecdotes are wildly exaggerated, unspeakably crude, and graphic adventures, usually involving his penis, but without the earnest and self-deprecating charm of his friend Stephen's accounts. Adam's comedy material runs along pretty predictable lines, referring to his dill-bread starter, for instance, as dildo, accompanied by a maniacal laugh. He has an unusual and frankly terrifying tic. When he eats, one eye rolls up into its socket. I'm told he makes funny faces when he has sex, too, but I try very hard not to picture that. He's a sentimental guy who can take real pride in his work. I've seen him weep when his tiramisu didn't come out as planned and when a cassata cake he'd made began to slide in the heat. He sulks, wheedles, whines, and bullies when he wants something, which is always, and you can pretty much tell what frame of mind he's in from his appearance. If he hasn't shaved, it's not a good time to be around him. At Sullivan's, I'd schedule his baking shifts at night after the kitchen closed. I did not want him interacting with the other cooks. His faux macho banter with the Ecuadorian and Mexican line cooks invariably caused offense, and he was an incurable slob. You will arrive in my kitchen promptly at 1 a.m. You will bake my bread, and you will be gone by the time my first cook arrives in the morning, were my instructions. I did not want him telling my garde-manger guy that he was going to make him his woman, or bragging about some imaginary or real adventure at the Casa de Putas, or singing witlessly obscene and unfunny Christmas carols to the dishwashers who saw him as a near satanic apparition. Allowing Adam to work unsupervised at night, however, meant that he would lift my reach-in doors off the hinges to help himself to midnight snacks of T-bone steaks, white truffle risotto, and tomato salad, washed down, no doubt, with a bottle of pilfered Dom Perignon now and again. But that was to be expected. The bread, it was so good. The first few months of Adam's employment were always the honeymoon. He showed up pretty much on time, producing one way or the other what was required. Then, when things were going well, the customers commenting favorably on the product, his masters happy, he'd start to enter a fugue state, martyr mode, where he'd begin sulking, feeling put upon, sorry for himself. All that work he was doing by himself, all that fine Adam bread, was underappreciated by his cruel and insensitive overlords. He would begin trying to jack me up for more money, demanding restitution for expenses, taxis, and research. He'd want new equipment, massive amounts of specialty baking goods, the authorization to phone up companies and spend money autonomously. In short, he'd become insufferable. When his demands weren't met, he'd start slacking and not showing up for work. The feed-the-bitch calls would become more frequent. That's usually when I began buying bread out. And that's when Adam, not eligible for unemployment benefits, would go back to making sandwiches at the Yankee Doodle Deli, brunch cooking at West Side Saloons, consulting to some crack-brained pizzeria owner or novice restaurateur, freelancing for deadbeat caterers, or just lying around his apartment. He'd print up another resume, another tissue of lies, invariably with another last name, and he'd start all over, and sooner or later I'd call him again, or Sears would, and Adam, real last name unknown, would be back in the saddle again. Adam can surprise you. He gets along well with my wife. He's actually polite in stretches. For the last few years, something of a record for Adam, he's been working for a very fine caterer and apparently doing good work there. I turned on public access cable one night to see Adam, in chef's whites, exchanging witty banter with a late-night cable host and guests, holding his own very nicely. He was delightful and funny and fast on his feet, and he had an impressive display of baked goods laid out on a table to sample. He's still making bread and pizzas for Jimmy Sears. For some time, I have heard no tales of violent assaults or $13 whorehouses or near overdoses, so maybe he really has cleaned up his act. God knows, a man who can make those perfect rough-slashed bowls of sourdough and Tuscan country bread deserves his place in the sun, somewhere. He's the best at what he does, after all. The finest bread I've ever had, and the most expensive. In human cost, aggravation, and worry. Hiring Adam, real last name unknown, was always a trade-off. With God or Satan, I don't know. But it was usually worth it. Bread is the staff of life, and Adam, the unlikely source. Something else God has to answer for. Department of Human Resources. A good friend of mine, about a year into his first chef's job, had a problem with one of his cooks. This particularly rotten bastard had been giving my friend a ride for quite a while, showing up late, not showing up, getting high at work, behaving insolently, and fomenting dissent among his co-workers. Convinced that the whole kitchen revolved around his station, his mood swings, and his toil, he felt free to become a raving, snarling, angry lunatic, a dangerously loose cannon rolling around on deck, just daring his chef and his co-workers to press the wrong button. After a no-show and a late arrival and yet another ugly histrionic incident of insubordination, my friend had no choice but to fire his cocaine-stoked and deranged employee, telling him in classic style to clean out your locker and get the fuck out. The cook went home, made a few phone calls, and then hanged himself. It's a measure of what we do for a living that this kind of a thing could happen, and that my friend, on his next visit to my kitchen, was greeted with gestures of mimed strangulation, cooks and waiters holding a hand over their heads, sticking their tongues out and rolling their eyes up, tagging my friend to his face as serial killer and remorselessly teasing him. My friend had worked for me for years and had at various times caused me much grief and frustration. Since becoming a chef in his own right, however, he'd taken to calling me at intervals to apologize for his past bad acts, telling me that when faced with managerial problems of his own involving personnel or human resource difficulties, he'd seriously regretted all the pain and worry he'd caused me. Now he knew, you see. He knew what it was like to be a leader of cooks, a wrangler of psychopaths, the captain of his own pirate ship, and he wasn't liking that part of the job very much. Now somebody was dead, and there was inarguably a causal relationship between the event of the troublesome cook's firing and his death by his own hand. The guy was fucked up anyway, it's not your fault, was the standard conciliatory remark. It was about as sympathetic as any of us could get. Guy would have done it sooner or later, man, if not with you, some other chef. That didn't quite cut it either. The guy had to go, is what I said. The kind of cold-blooded statement not unusual for me when in chef mode. What? You gonna keep the guy on? Let him talk shit to you in front of your crew? Let him show up late? Fuck up service because you're afraid he's gonna off himself? Fuck him. We're on a lifeboat, baby. The weak, the dangerous, the infirm, they go over the side. Typically, I was overstating the case. I've coddled plenty of dangerously unstable characters over the years. I've kept on plenty of people who I knew, in the end, would make me look bad and become more trouble than they were worth. I'm not saying I'm Mr. Rogers, a softy. Okay, maybe I am saying that a little bit. I appreciate people who can show up every day and do the best they can, in spite of borderline personalities, substance abuse problems, and antisocial tendencies. And I'm often inclined to give them every opportunity to change their trajectories, to help them to arrive at a different outcome than the predictable one when they begin to visibly unravel. But once gone, quit, fired, or dead, I move on to the next problem. There always is one. There have been a lot of success stories out of my kitchens over the last two decades, mostly Mexicans and Ecuadorians who now own homes, have careers, enjoy the respect of their peers and their neighbors. They support families, drive their own cars, speak English fluently, all things I can barely do. I care about my crew and their problems. I go home Saturday night with a sulking cook getting crispy around the edges on my mind, someone in my kitchen talking about going AWOL, exhibiting symptoms of the dreaded martyr mode. My weekend is ruined. All I'm going to be thinking about for every waking minute is that cook and what I can do to fix the situation. I'll lie there on the bed, staring into space, paying scant attention to the TV or what my wife is talking about or the everyday tasks of bill paying, maintaining a home, behaving like a normal person. I don't know, you see, how a normal person acts. I don't know how to behave outside my kitchen. I don't know the rules. I'm aware of them, sure. But I don't care to observe them anymore because I haven't had to for so many years. Okay, I can put on a jacket, go out for dinner and a movie, and I can eat with a knife and fork without embarrassing my hosts. But can I really behave? I don't know. I have responsibilities, I tell myself and my wife. I've got things on my mind. I'm in charge of people's lives, and it can weigh heavily on me. In my world, you see, my friend is a killer. No, he's not, you say. How could he have predicted what this drug-addled maniac was going to do? How can what some cokehead cook has done to himself and to his family be laid at his door? Because it can. Because when you look somebody in the eyes and can them, there's no telling what terrible result might ensue. He might come at you with a meat cleaver or a boning knife. He might, like Adam Real Last Name Unknown, drag you into court on whatever specious yet embarrassing grounds. He might turn tail and simply leave the business, move to Arizona and sell insurance, as one talented cook of my acquaintance did. On the other hand, he could simply suck it up, move on to the next kitchen, and make a smashing success of himself. 10 years in the future, you might find yourself standing next to him at the James Beard Awards dinner, when he's just picked up his award for Best New Chef, and resplendent in his tux, he turns and pees smilingly on your pants leg. These are all considerations when peering down the line at some troubled and troubling employee and pondering his fate. Survival has its costs. I took a fateful cab ride many years ago, rolling back from the Lower East Side with a bunch of close friends, all of us fresh from scoring dope. I jokingly remarked on an article I'd seen detailing the statistical likelihood of successfully detoxing. Only 1 in 4 has a chance at making it, ha ha ha, I said, my words ringing immediately painful and hollow as soon as I'd said them. I counted our number in the back of that rattling checker marathon, 4, and right there I knew that if one of us was getting off dope and staying off dope, it was going to be me. I wasn't going to let these guys drag me down. I didn't care what it took, how long I'd known them, and what we'd been through together, or how close we'd been. I was going to live. I was the guy. I made it. They didn't. I don't feel guilty about that. We're in a lifeboat, begins one of my standard inspirationals to new sous chefs. We're 4 days out to sea, with no rescue in sight. There are 2 Snickers bars and a tiny hunk of salt pork left in our stores, and that fat bastard by the stern is getting crazier with every hour, becoming more and more irrational and demanding, giving that Snickers bar long, lingering looks, even though he's too weak to help with the rowing or the bailing anymore. He presents a clear and present danger to the rest of us, what with his leering at the food and his recently acquired conviction that we're plotting against him. What do we do? We kick Fat Boy over the side, I say. Maybe we even carve a nice chunk of rum steak off his thigh before letting him go. Is that wrong? Yeah, tough guy. Sure you do that. To which I'd say, you don't know me very well. Insurrection, direct challenge to my authority, treasonous dereliction of duty, the time will come, my friend, when it's going to be you going over the side. I will, and I tell my cooks this ahead of time, contrive, conspire, manipulate, maneuver, and betray in order to get you out of my kitchen, whatever the outcome to you personally. If an unexpected period of unemployment inspires you to leap off a bridge, hang yourself from a tree, or chug a lug of quart of drain cleaner, that is too bad. The absolutes first attracted me to this business, along with the food thing, the black and white of it. The knowledge that there's some things you must do and some things you absolutely must not. What little order there has been in my life is directly related to this belief in clear right and clear wrong. Maybe not moral distinctions, but practical ones. Another cook has to cover for you, wrong. Chef spending too much time kissing your boo-boos, stroking your ego, solving your conflicts with coworkers, wrong. Talking back to your leader, wrong. You will soon become dead to me. My friend, the novice killer, feeling truly awful about what happened, said, Tony, I'm different than you. I have a heart. I laughed and took that for a compliment, which it kind of was, if a backhanded one. I do have a heart, you see. I've got plenty of heart. I'm a fucking sentimental guy once you get to know me. Show me a hurt puppy, or a long-distance telephone service commercial, or a film retrospective of Ali fights, or Lou Gehrig's last speech, and I'll weep real tears. I am a bastard when crossed, though, no question. I bully my waiters, but at least I comfort myself afterwards. When I wonder if maybe I went a little too far, at least I don't bite them on the nose, as one chef I know did. I don't throw plates, much. I don't blame others for my mistakes. I'm attentive to the weak but willing, if merciless to the strong who are not so eager to please. Though slothful to a fault in my off hours, I am not lazy at work, and I am fiercely protective of my crew, of my chain of command, of my turf. I have perjured myself on a cook's behalf. I will cut off my nose to spite my face. If a favored cook's well-being is at stake, meaning I will quit a job rather than let management, ownership, or anybody else toy with any member of my crew, I will walk out of a perfectly good situation if somebody insists on squeezing my cooks for unreasonable amounts of extra work at no additional recompense. I'm not bluffing when I threaten to quit over principle. My loyalty, such as it is to my restaurant, if that loyalty is not to the detriment of dedicated underlings. The ones who've hung with me, endured what I think should be reasonably endured, have done the right thing. Everything else is just noise, isn't it? The Life of Brian. There are better chefs in the world. One comes reluctantly yet undeniably to that conclusion early in one's career. There's always some old master or new hotshot who's doing things with food you never would have thought of if they hadn't done it first. And of course, in the thin air at the peak of the culinary Mount Olympus, where the 3- and 4-star demigods dwell, guys like Eric Repair, Grey Coons, Boulet, Paladin, Keller, you know the names, I don't have to tell you, they have the added advantage of not only being geniuses or near geniuses, but they tend to command crews that are larger, better trained, and more single-minded in their zeal. This didn't just happen, mind you. These guys don't get hundreds of hungry young culinarians banging on their kitchen doors, begging for the privilege of mopping their brows and peeling their shallots just because they have their name stitched on their jackets. Nobody is building million-dollar kitchen facilities around their chef, shelling out for combi steamers, induction burners, fine china, jade ranges, crystal snifters, and fistfuls of white truffles because the guy can sling steaks faster than the other guy or because he has a cute accent. Cream rises. Excellence does have its rewards. For every Schlockmeister with a catchphrase and his own line of prepared seasonings who manages to hold American television audiences enthralled, there are scores more who manage to show up at work every day in a real kitchen and produce brilliantly executed, innovatively presented, top-quality food. I am naturally pissed off by the former and hugely impressed by the latter. But for my money, the guy I know who embodies the culinary ideal, a no-bullshit, no-muss, no-fuss, old-school, ass-kicking cook of the first order, that would have to be Scott Bryan down the street at Veritas. I'd been hearing about this guy for years, significantly from other chefs and cooks. Scott says this and Scott says that, and Scott doesn't make veal stock. He's roasting chicken bones, buys fresh killed in like Chinatown. Somebody would mention his name in passing, and other chefs would get this curious expression on their faces, like the runner of Satchel Paige's admonition, don't look back, someone might be gaining on you. They'd look worried, as if examining their own hearts and souls and abilities, they were aware that not only couldn't they do what Scott does, but they wouldn't. He was a cult figure, it seemed, among cooks of my acquaintance. Over time, I developed an idea of him as some sort of hair-shirt ascetic, a mad monk, a publicity-shy perfectionist who'd rather do no business at all, die in obscurity, than ever serve a bad meal. The whole world of cooking is not my world, contrary to what impression I might have given you in the preceding pages. Truth be told, I bring a lot of it with me. Hang out in the Veritas kitchen, take a hard look at Scott Bryan's operation, and you will find that everything I've told you so far is wrong, that all my sweeping generalities, rules of thumb, preconceptions, and general principles are utter bullshit. In my kitchens, I'm in charge, it's always my ship, and the tenor, tone, and hierarchy, even the background music, are largely my doing. A chef who plays old Sex Pistols songs while he breaks down chickens for coq au vin is sending a message to his crew, regardless of his adherence to any Escoffier-era merit system. A guy who employs year after year a sous chef like Stephen Temple is clearly not Robuchon, or likely to emulate his successes. It is no coincidence that all my kitchens over time come to resemble one another and are reminiscent of the kitchens I grew up in, noisy, debauched, and overloaded with faux testosterone. An effective kitchen, but a family affair, and a dysfunctional one at that. I coddle my hooligans when I'm not bullying them. I'm visibly charmed by their extracurricular excesses and their antisocial tendencies. My love for chaos, conspiracy, and the dark side of human nature colors the behavior of my charges, most of whom are already living near the fringes of acceptable conduct. So there are different kinds of kitchens than the kinds I run. Not all kitchens are the press gang crude pressure cookers I'm used to. There are islands of reason and calm where the pace is steady, where quality always takes precedence over the demands of volume, and where it's not always about dick, dick, dick. As we close in on hotel motel time, let's compare and contrast. Let's take a look at a 3-star chef who runs a very different kind of kitchen than mine, who makes food at a higher level, has had a nearly unblemished track record of working with the best in the business, a guy who has always kept his eye on the ball, which is to say, the food. If I suffer by comparison, so be it. I think I said earlier that I was going to tell you the truth. This is part of it. Scott Bryan, like me, happily refers to himself as a marginal character. When he says marginal, you can hear his hometown of Brookline, Massachusetts in his voice, the same accent you hear in body shops and Irish bars in Worcester, New Bedford, Gloucester, and Framingham. Scott uses the term dude a lot, though, which leads one to believe there might be surf in Boston. When I dropped by to see him recently, passing first through his stylishly sparse 65-seat dining room, past his 4 sommeliers, count them, 4, through a kitchen staffed by serious-looking young Americans in buttoned-up regard jackets with the Veritas logo stitched on their breasts and chefwear MC Hammer pants down a flight of stairs, I found him wrapping a howitzer-sized log of foie gras in cheesecloth. He was wearing a short-sleeved dishwasher shirt, snaps done up to the collar, Alice in Chains blaring in the background. I took inordinate comfort from this, thinking, I do that, maybe we're not so different. But of course, we are very different, as you shall see. Scott grew up in what he calls a housing development, a project, really, unlike me, who grew up in a leafy green wonderland of brick colonial homes, distant lawnmowers, backyard croquet games, gurgling goldfish ponds, and Cheever-esque cocktail parties. Scott went to Brookline High, a public school, where the emphasis seems to have been on technical skills. They had a culinary program and a restaurant open to the public. I went to private school, a Tweedy institution where kids wore Brooks Brothers jackets with the school seal and Latin motto, Veritas Fortissima, on the breast pocket. Scott learned early that he might have to actually work for a living, whereas I, a product of the new frontier and great society, honestly believed that the world pretty much owed me a living. All I had to do was wait around in order to live better than my parents. At an age when I was helping to rack up my friends' parents' expensive automobiles and puking up Boone's Farms on Persian carpets, Scott was already working for Henry Kinnison at the Brookline High restaurant. He was doing it for money. Junior year, he took a job in a Hungarian continental joint and as a fishmonger at Boston's Legal Seafood. One worked, and that was it. Scott, though still unmoved by the glories of food, found that he preferred cooking to his other imagined career option, electrical engineer or electrician. His early mentor, Kinnison, urged him to attend Johnson & Wales' culinary program in Providence, and along the lines of why not, he went along. He hated it. While studying, he began working for Bob Kincaid at the much-vaunted Harvest Restaurant in Cambridge, and if there is a single epiphany in Scott Bryan's life, a single moment when he decided what it was he was going to do for the rest of his life, it was there, when he first tasted Kincaid's lobster salad with foie gras and truffle vinaigrette. His reaction was immediate. He decided to leave Johnson & Wales. I'm not going back, he said, abandoning culinary school for life in the real world. He was good. He had to be. Kincaid clearly knew he was onto something. With Scott barely out of high school, Kincaid packed him off to France with the one-word instruction, eat. Like me, Scott is conflicted on the issue of the French. We like to minimize their importance, make fun of their idiosyncrasies. It's a different system over there, he said, talking about the work habits of the surrender monkey. You start young. For the first 10 years of your career, you get your ass kicked. They work you like a dog. So when you finally get to be a sous chef or a chef, your working life is pretty much over. You walk around and point. Putting a last twist on his foie gras torpedo, he shrugged. Socialism, man. It's not good for cooks. But when he sees bad technique, technique that's not French, it's torture. As Scott well knows and would be the first to admit, as soon as you pick up a chef's knife and approach food, you're already in debt to the French. Talking about one of the lowest points in his career, a kitchen in California, he described going home every night ashamed and a little bit angry because the technique was bad. It wasn't French. They may owe us a big one for Omaha Beach, but let's face it, without my stinky ancestors, we'd still be eating ham steak with pineapple ring. Scott knows this better than anybody. Back from France, he rejoined Kincaid, opening 21 Federal with him on Nantucket. Now, here exactly is where our career paths divide. Scott had some chops now. He was good on the line. He had a resume, some notable names and recommendations, working experience, exposure to France, and French food. So did I at that point in my career. I was good. I'd been to France. I had a CIA diploma at a time when that was a pretty rare and impressive credential. So what the hell happened? How come I'm not a three-star chef? Why don't I have four sommeliers? Well, there are lots of reasons. But one reason is that I went for the money. The first chef's job that came along, I grabbed. And the one after that, and the one after that. Used to a certain quality of life, as divorcees like to call it, living in the style to which I'd grown accustomed, I was unwilling to take a step back and maybe learn a thing or two. Scott was smarter and more serious. He was more single-minded about what he wanted to do and how well he wanted to do it. He began a sort of wandering apprenticeship, sensibly designed to build experience over a bank account. He came to New York and went to work for Brendan Walsh and Arizona 206 are names that seem to pop up in the resumes of almost every 80s-era American chef. John Tizar, Kerry Heffernan, Pat Williams, Jeff Kent, Maurice Rodriguez, Herb Wilson, Donnie Masterton, everyone had seen pass through those kitchen doors at some point in their early careers. And for Scott, it was his version of the happy time, a period where everyone knew what we were doing was important. It was a team of cooks. From this early petri dish of culinary talent, Scott moved onwards and upwards, parlaying one once-in-a-lifetime gig into another, racking up a box score of famous chefs and heavyweight talents that would make any ambitious young cookie jerk to attention just at the mention of their names. The Gotham with Alfred Portale. Back with Kincaid at 21 Federal in D.C., Square One in California. Back to New York with David Boulay. A Hamptons interlude with Jimmy Sears. Pause for breath here. Sous chef for Eric Repair at Le Bernardin. As if his career wasn't going swimmingly enough for a guy who only a few years earlier had been considering a life installing light sockets and fuse boxes, he then opened L'Espinasse with Grey Coons. And if this isn't rich enough meal for you, to round out his skills and ensure his usefulness as an all-around major league player, he crossed the line from a la carte cuisine to pastry, a nearly unthinkable act, and went to work with the awesome uber-pâtissier Richard Leach at Mondrian. See what I mean? I would never have done that. If I had a well-disposed Eric Repair and Grey Coons in my background, I'd be endorsing blenders, committing unnatural acts in the pool near the Vegas outpost of my not-very-good-anymore restaurant chain, and pickling my liver in Louis Trey's. At that point in my career, I wouldn't be shutting down the whole gravy train so I could learn pastry. I'd be mugging it up on the Food Network, schmoozing at the Beard Awards dinner, and contemplating a future where I'd never have to get out of my pajamas. Just goes to show you, Scott hates all that stuff. His partner, Gino Diaferia, says, I have to drag him kicking and screaming to do a guest shot on Letterman, appear on the Food Network, or do the dog and pony act at the Beard House. I told him he could get 4 stars someday, he says. He doesn't want it. Gino shakes his head and smiles. He says he won't play with his food that much. Is it all about the food with this guy? I don't know. Scott likes to refer to himself as a cook, and when he says about another chef, he's a good cook, it's the highest praise he can offer. Sopping up free martinis at the Veritas bar, I asked Gino whether he thought Scott was in it for the food or for the lifestyle. It gave him pause. I don't know. He seemed clearly troubled by the question. I mean, I think he likes the lifestyle. A guy who comes in and hangs around on his day off, you know he's got to like the lifestyle. And he loves going out after work with cooks and chefs for drinks, you know. He paused and thought about the question again. But... Gino is another example of everything I just told you was wrong. Here's a guy who was in the home fuel oil business with zero restaurant experience, who became partners with a couple of guys for a lark at the then-vegetarian Chelsea Bistro Luma. When things began to lose their charm, he bought out the partners and began spending all his time at the restaurant, learning the business from the ground up. I was supposed to be a silent partner. Looking around for a chef, a waiter who had worked for Fishmongers to the Stars Wild Edibles told him Scott Bryan is available. I met with him at a coffee shop. He looked at the menu and said, "No vegetarian, that's gotta go." I said, fine. Scott said maybe he'd consult. He came in, started working, changing things. Months go by, 6 months. I look at my wife and she looks at me. Is he consulting? Is he staying? I kept asking him, Scott, can we make a deal? Finally, one day he says, well, I think I will stay. The rest, as they say, is history. Luma got a quick 2 stars from Ruth Reichel at the New York Times and lots of buzz. Restaurants that change their entire approach midstream never succeed. Remember I told you that? Wrong. Restaurants owned by guys in the fuel business don't succeed. I might have said something like that too. Wrong. Operations that expand into multi-units often dilute the qualities that made them good in the first place. Not this time. Time passed, Luma did well, and Gino and Scott opened Indigo on West 10th Street, in a spot so poisonous, so reeking of failure that 8 or 9 restaurants had come and gone in my memory alone. Remember all that yammer about cancerous locations, sites so cursed that any and all who seek to follow are doomed? Wrong again, jerk. Indigo was located only a few blocks away from 1-5. I'd been hearing quite enough about Scott Bryan, so when the place opened, I remember trudging over in the middle of a blizzard, sitting at the bar and scarfing up free tastings. I thought it was mind-bogglingly good, and I told people so. I dragged my crew over one by one to try the mushroom strudel, the manila clams. We marveled at Scott's menu, the perfect my way or the highway document. All the things that conventional wisdom tells a chef he has to do, all those must-have crowd pleasers that eat up half your menu before you can sneak in the selections you actually love, they weren't there. There was no soup, no vegetarian plate, no steak. The chicken was not some generic roasted bird with non-threatening seasonings. It was a weird, ballsy, spicy concoction involving red curry, for Christ's sake, and good. The only beef was braised shoulder, adobe Provençal so good that my whole crew at 1-5 now ran over to Indigo after work. Our two kitchens closed at the same time, so we'd phone ahead to say we were coming over and start cooking that dobe. Just put it on the bar, for God's sake. Let it get cold. It's okay. The Indigo seafood selections were admirably unpopular fishes, cod and mackerel, and exciting. This was food for cooks. This was food that we got. Simple, straightforward, and absolutely pretense-free. Like Scott. Tucking into that dobe of beef or Scott's sweetbreads was fun for me and my appreciative crew. What's he doing, we wanted to know, while examining a particular item we hadn't tried yet. How was he dealing with mackerel? Then we'd find out. Everything on Scott's plates is edible. It's food, first and foremost, to be eaten, not looked at, though his presentations are inspired. Try and imagine the clean, unfussy integrity of Japanese cuisine with the unrestrained flavors and soul food heartiness of a well-remembered grandma's best dish. He was braising economy cuts. He was taking greasy, oily fishes that nobody wanted and making magic. He was presenting it in big bowls and pretty stacks where, if you jammed your fork through all three layers, you got something that combined to actually taste good. He wasn't piling food on top of itself because layer one looked good on top of layer two and three. It tasted good that way. In those big bowls, at Indigo and at Veritas, when something comes in a big bowl, it's because there's going to be sauce left in the bottom. Chances are you're going to be running a crust of bread around in there and mopping it up when the entree has been eaten. It's why Scott has 3 stars and I don't. It's why he probably won't be getting 4 stars anytime soon. His food is too good and too much fun to eat. You feel you can put your elbows on the table in a Scott Bryan Gino Diaferia restaurant and get about the serious business of tasting and smelling and chewing the good stuff. I asked Scott if he thinks about food after work. When he's lying in bed in the dark, is he thinking about what he's going to run for special tomorrow? He said no. I come in, see what's on the market, I wing it, he replied. I didn't believe him. Does Scott think about food when he's not working? I asked Gino out of Scott's hearing. He smiled. He thinks about food, Gino said. A lot. Scott is 34 years old. He's got dark boyish good looks with an eccentric nose that looks right on a chef. There are dark blue rings under his eyes, and he has the skin pallor of a man who spent too many hours toiling under fluorescent kitchen lighting. He wears the bemused expression of a guy who knows how bad it can get, who's always looking and waiting for the other shoe to drop. He's not so much a screamer anymore. I used to blow up all the time. I still yell if there's laziness, sloppiness, someone thinks they're getting over. Pointed sarcasm seems more the preferred tactic these days, and he does not share my pleasure in handling a pirate crew. Someone has a problem with another cook in my kitchen, I tell them work it out amongst themselves. I don't have time for that. I say, work it out, because if you still have a problem with so-and-so tomorrow, you're gone. Maybe you're both gone. He doesn't bully, harangue, or excoriate. The occasional caustic comment seems chillingly effective. I hung out in the Veritas kitchen recently, knocked off work at Leal, and ran over to see how the other half works. It's a very quiet place. During the middle of the rush on a Friday night, with a full dining room, the pace was positively relaxing. More a seriously focused waltz than the kind of hard-checking mosh pit slam dancing I live with. No one was screaming, nobody was kicking any oven doors closed, putting any English on the plates, or hurling pots into the sink. Scott expediting, never raised his voice. "Go on entrees, 32, he said in a near whisper. That's all it took for five line cooks to swing into action and start converging on plates. Pick up, he said. Table 12. Three waiters appeared, each expertly wiping, garnishing, and finishing a different plate, squeezing drops of chive oil, lobster oil, or 30-year-old balsamic from eyedropper-sized squeeze bottles.